So synchronicity has struck again. You know, it does all the time, and we only notice it sometimes. So I've been talking recently about sort of basic teachings. I was talking about craving a couple of weeks ago, and so after that I said, well, why don't I just talk about the Buddha? So I started thinking about that, and then I received a journal from Barry Institute for Buddhist Studies that's associated with the Insight Meditation Society in Barry, Massachusetts, and Andrew Olensky had written an article called The Radical Buddha. I said, hey, that's how I see him too, so I read that. And then someone said, hey, there's going to be a show on PBS on Buddhism. I said, oh, yeah, well, I don't get television. Tell me, but someone could tell me about it later. And then a friend sent me a link. Someone said, I guess it was you, said, gee, that was kind of interesting. And someone sent me a link, and I looked at it this morning. It's all about the Buddha. So, but what am I talking about today? The Buddha. Maybe it's in the air. You know, we have these, no one knows if he was born in the springtime, but that's when it's celebrated because you can have a lot of flowers and all the myths. And the stories relate to, you know, this said bursting forth into life and into bloom. And most of Buddhist Asia celebrates the Buddha's birthday at the beginning of May, and that's when we do. Japan celebrates at the beginning of April, but the weather's dicey here in April. Both first Sundays of April are pretty soggy, so we will celebrate the first Sunday in May with the Buddha's birthday, flower house and bathing the baby Buddha and things of that sort. But maybe that may be why there's so much about the Buddha right now, April, May. So his Shakyamuni's life was interesting, like that of any great person. Right? There are things to glean from the life of any great person, both the history and the myths around them. And he's a kind of icon, a symbol of his own teaching. And those are two pretty good things right there. And his teaching... But his teaching itself still is alive. It inspires and it guides today. So it's appropriate to appreciate his gifts and to be grateful. But what about he himself as a person? Is there something relevant there? Is there a person behind the statue on the altar and the icon in all the pictures? So most Buddhist schools refer to him simply as the Buddha, which means the awakened one. You know, in India at that time, there was a great... People spoke of wanting to find a Buddha, an awakened one. For there was a need for a Buddha, so that the need was already there, and he filled it. But and so he has been, because he's the Buddha, he's been almost deified, maybe more than almost in some traditions. But in Zen, calls him Shakyamuni. Doesn't say he's not the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, but he's referred to a lot as Shakyamuni, as the name he went by in the second part of his lifetime after his enlightenment when he became teacher. It's not out of disrespect to call him Shakyamuni, but to remind us that he was a person. And that it is as a person that he practiced, as a person he awoke, as a person he taught, and as a person he died. An old man, sick, he died. But his life was long ago and far away and very different from ours. And his enlightenment was so much more complete or thorough than the insights we arrive at. So is there something relevant in his life, as his personness, that would be relevant or nourishing for our lives? Well, the statues of him, the sculptures, all the images always look very serene, transcendentally serene, and utterly unlike us, even to the point of having Asian features, which a few of us have, but not so many around here, and nor did he probably have features like that. That's the iconographic traditions developed in countries where he was made to look more or less like the people who were revering him. But at any rate, his teachings and the best records that we have of him and his life are not about transcendental serenity. They're about a life of searching and sharing, rewarding, painful, difficult. This deep awareness of the suffering of all life and how to relieve it. That was his interest. What is the reality in which the suffering takes place, and how can you relieve it? And that's, well, our lives are about searching and sharing, and they're difficult, they're painful, and they're sometimes rewarding. Our focus is in many ways on the reality of suffering in our lives and on how to alleviate or end that. And his plan of how to accomplish this, meeting the realities of life and finding peace, his plan, which came to him in his enlightenment, was to understand reality deeply and then to find how to live in accord with that reality. So, you know, really not completely unlike us after all. He left home when he was a young man because he had a compelling need for a truth bigger than the one he had available to him at that time. And big enough and deep enough to make sense of the complexities of life. And all life is complex. Life in northern India in 500 years before the Common Era, was complex. Our lives are busy and complex and digital and worldly and swirling. And life in northern India was busy, complex, and swirling at that time. The old Brahmin order was giving way, and Hinduism was developing out of it pretty much at the same time. What became the modern, what's recognized as Hinduism, was developing more or less at the same time as the Shakyamuni. It was a time of a great many seekers dissatisfied with the, you can't hardly say the status quo, because there wasn't really, there was a time of great ferment and change, dissatisfied with what was around them. And the flow was toward a some kind of spiritual understanding via some kind of practice. So not exactly dropping out, although it's all this description of yogic separation from life, is, we can perceive that as a separation or a retreat, but it was about seeking a better way to live, or dropping out of one set of priorities to pick up another set, to find another set to pick up. So there was a belief in the air at that time that spiritual insight was possible. I'd say that's in some ways one of the differences. It's not a commonly in the air in our world that spiritual insight is possible. And that was very much present as a pregnant possibility. So that spiritual insight was possible and would be productive, and that you had to do something to bring it about. You had to do some kind of practice. Many felt in that time that you had to give up everything of the world and family and work and possessions and things in order to be free of their pull on your life, their pull toward status and a clinging and greed and envy. So give it up altogether would seem to be a way out of that. That's an idea that works better from outside than from inside. And there are cultural currents always in the air, and sometimes they are more vivid and present, and I think there's a time when we feel buffeted by them a lot. In every era, there are cultural currents that look like counterculture. In the 60s, there was a movement toward dropping out of mainstream society and its striving, and then there was kind of worked in with that. There was working for social justice and for peace in some quarters. Then in the 80s and 90s, I saw sort of a cult of financial prosperity. That was how it looked to me anyway. And now there's a movement toward organic farming and sustainable living and a whole crop of 20-somethings, 18 to 30-year-olds who are trying to actually take, and others too, but there's a real movement. You see it when this first coming of age, there's a strong movement towards farming and growing and finding ways to relate through that to a way of life. They're not so much countercultures as correctives, to a one-sidedness in a social order. And our world feels unstable. Our world is unstable. And we happen to feel it because it's very unstable. That's, you know, it's... But the instability is not only a problem. It's an opening. It's a push towards questioning and towards seeking. And in Shakyamuni's time, the sort of this cultural current that would look like counterculture, this was this kind of spiritual seeking. And there were yogic meditation disciplines, and there were body disciplines. There were to the point of starvation or standing on one leg or looking at the sun till you went blind. There were some bizarre ones. And the harsh and narrow ones were not productive, but all of them expressed, I thought, well, what these seem so, some of them, so limited, but they all expressed, you have to do something. And we grope. We don't know what to do, so we do something. So this all this spiritual seeking involved doing something, involved some form of practice. And Shakyamuni tried many of them. Especially, first he tried meditation schools, then sort of philosophical meditative schools that taught one order of reality and another order of reality. And he mastered them and said, okay, but that's not complete. And then he moved to asceticism, moving further into some kind of body life practice. And he describes that he pushed asceticism so far, because he was, after all, a particularly dedicated seeker, that one time he was so weak that when he stood up to urinate, he fell over into his own urine and said, this does not make sense. No. This is not a productive path. This is a dead end. Recognizing a dead end in the path you're going in is very hard. Being at the closed end of a direction that you have known how to go in, you know, kind of fundus, going through a tunnel. It's often hard to tunnel through. It feels difficult. And to find that it seems to be a closed end, very, very painful. Very hard to know what to do next. And there's a certain tendency to retreat into distractions and addictions because we don't know what to do. There's a tendency to try to make a nest there, gather what little straw and blankets you can find and curl up there and try to make do. Or there's gropingly seeking a new direction. So it's very important. It must have been important to Shakyamuni too, because if you try to grope in a new direction, you're going to be awkward, you're going to feel inadequate, you're not going to be good at it. And to recognize that that's not your inadequacy, your problem, that that's the nature of the situation. To have to grope in a new direction, to switch the direction from where you've been going, to find a new way when you don't know what that would be like, it's going to be awkward, it's going to be, you can feel inadequate, it's going to be difficult, it's going to be messy and groping, and feel like you're not nothing's happening furthermore. It's very difficult to recognize that that's not us, that's natural to that situation. That's a part of the landscape of finding, of seeking. If we were really good at it, we wouldn't be seeking. We wouldn't be seeking anymore. Zen is called the way seeking, way seeker's path. Seeking itself is what we do. It's not just a means to an end. And that's one of the reasons we need company. Because to do that alone is very difficult. So Shakyamuni left off the asceticism, and he had left some form of wealthy ease behind, and now he left the ascetic extreme behind, and he's in uncharted territory. We don't know what to do in uncharted territory. Someone just sent me, a Zen teacher, I hadn't had a chance to click on it, but a line from somebody that said, I try to not know for as long as possible. That's pretty good. So that then something new can happen when I go toward knowing. I try to not know for as long as possible. Very difficult. Very uncomfortable. So what Shakyamuni did was left a life of being enveloped in comfort or clinging to the idea of a permanent, substantial way of life. And he also didn't turn away from life in asceticism. So he found instead, he said those two that he had both, that he knew, were not productive. They were too partial. They were exclusionary, and they pushed away. And he found the way of the center. That's what the middle way is. It's not like the law of averages. It's not the median number. It's the way of the center. It's the way of the middle. And he called himself a pathfinder, not a path maker. So he lived a life and taught a teaching, a dharma, that was radical in his times. Not through seeking to be radical or to reform society, but to go directly ahead out of what he had come to understand. Say, okay, I have an understanding from his insights and from his trying to digest and integrate that into his life of a way to live, and he tried to live by that, and that expressed radically in terms of what was around him. So it was radical to ordain women, to see and validate our capacity. It was radical not to be guided by caste and social status in his order. When someone became a monk, entered that social order, their seniority and status was by the day they were ordained. Upali the barber was ordained before a bunch of noblemen, and he had a higher, since he was their senior, and to the extent that they had rank, which wasn't a great deal, he held it, became a great monk. It was radical to teach both lay and ordained people, which he did. He addressed his talks to the four groups, the monks, the nuns, the laymen, the laywomen. And he taught anyone who wanted to listen. It was radical to accept prostitutes, widows, thieves, slaves, all kinds of lowlifes. Radical thieves, widows, and slaves come up specifically in the texts as followers, as monks and nuns. And it's equally radical for someone who's taken that kind of path to accept princes and wealthy merchants as well. And he didn't only accept everyone as followers, but as people capable of realization. And in terms of the world around him, that was radical. He was just doing life on the basis of his teaching. And this was radical. So he radically followed his insights, let's say, unwaveringly. That's one of the things that we look to. We waver. This is our human life. And he doesn't seem to have had a lot of wavering, although there are times of doubt, even in the middle of his life, not just before his awakening. 20 years into his teaching career, there was a schism. He had a cousin, apparently it was a cousin, who wanted to harm him and cause schism. And he had a period of, at least one recorded period of real doubt about what was going on, what he was doing. He was a human being. But he lived his life in this complete integrity of unwaveringly following his insights, his understanding, and his values. So he radically said, life creates life, death is part of life, all is impermanent, and all the parts are made of each other. He said, this is a universe of natural causes and effects. It's also radical. And that there's no reason to invoke gods or a permanent or eternal absolute. He radically said, learn to see how things really are yourself. And then live in those terms. Live in accord with the truth you find. And then he radically said, and this will free you from great suffering and from creating more suffering. And those teachings are still radical. Now, teachings are not only their content. And this, in Buddhism, any long-lived teaching, it gets tangled up. For instance, some of what he taught isn't radical now, isn't that doesn't have that kind of clarity, because there is everything is expressed. The contents of our insights and teachings are expressed in terms of the particular culture and understanding, worldly understandings we have. So, for instance, because his world's natural view was of a cycle of and sequence of lifetimes, he described the road out of unnecessary suffering in terms of leaving this cycle. That part of his view was local. We could even say parochial. I remember I grew up in New York City, and it wasn't when I went away to college from the far reaches of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and looked back at New York that I realized that living in the center of the universe was a very parochial place to be. It wasn't the center of the universe. It was just another local place. It was a big awakening that to be a New Yorker was just as parochial as to be from Dubuque. It took me a year or two to get that. But it was interesting. So the describing the path for Shakyamuni, describing his path as a way to know of release from suffering, as a way as of no more human lifetimes, is the local coloring, the kind of a content description of an underlying great truth. So looking back at his own life, is actually as he was lived in, as it's recorded as best we can tell in the many contradictory teachings we have. The sutras do contradict each other at every turn, because it's layers upon layers. Although he was teaching about a getting off a cycle of lifetimes in order to have peace, he lived peace in his lifetime. Even though he had a period of doubt, even though he had dysentery, even though he got old and undoubtedly achy and arthritic before he died at 83 or so. His teachings, as presented in the sutras, in the very earliest layers to the later layers, he had peace in this lifetime. He was living free of the compulsions of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And he was doing that in his life. And the reality of his own life shows this, that he was at peace in his life, even though his language for describing it was that this was almost like a prologue to a more permanent, nothing's permanent, kind of peace. So it's not just a matter of just picking and choosing based on our own local view which teaching to retain, because that's what it begins to look like. Well, I don't like that teaching. I don't like that teaching. You know, it doesn't fit my life. But that's a local view, and there's something to be said for does this work here, this teaching? But I'm also coming from my own local view, and local view meaning local view, we tend to have, you know, kind of cultural clashes, and now have no better basis for it. It's just as local a view. We're all little parochial nations here. So finding a way to know how to found our lives and what to base our lives on, and what of the Dharma, what of the Buddha or Shakyamuni might be relevant in our local nation where we live, this little parochial island that's not an island, without just basing it on my own parochial local views. Very interesting. It's not easy. It's very interesting. So, what is radical? You know, his teachings were radical in the context of the kinds of ideas they were. They were radical in terms of what they were, how they, if you have this, come to an understanding of reality, that you should try to live with human values on that reality. And it's radical to say, and that this will be an end of suffering. In addition, so then out of that, he did these things that were radical, like ordaining women and accepting thieves and slaves into his order and things like that. But really, I went back to my dictionary. You know? Because there's radical in it. It's about extremes, right? Extreme change, extreme political movements, all kinds of extreme shifts. But radical, I said to myself, is a root. Little, remember all those years of editing Wendy's book, you know. A radical is a root, or a little rootlet coming out of a root. So I went back to the dictionary, and that indeed is the origin of all the different forms of the word radical. Radix is a Latin word meaning root. So in some, how do we have what looks like extreme change meaning the same thing as rootedness? Root or essential. So radix is the root of plant roots, of linguistic language roots, of mathematical roots, of radicals are small groups of atoms that act freely in some reactions like a larger, as though, which are usually subunits of a larger molecule, you know, free radicals. Many kinds of radicals that are essentials or bases or the rootedness or fundamental. And then there are the more abstract meanings, which means essential or sometimes fundamental or extreme. Extreme departure. So Shakyamuni's radicalness may have looked then and it may look now. It has looked to me at times. It certainly was an extreme change, but it didn't come out of an intention to make extreme change. It wasn't an intent to revolutionize society. It wasn't an attempt to reform society. He wasn't trying to reform it, to make it easier to get along in society as it was. He was trying to help people transform their lives. So he went straight ahead, living a life and teaching a dharma that was in itself radical in his times. And so its expression would be radical in his time. Not through seeking to be radical or to reform, but to go directly ahead, living out the consequences of his insight, living out the consequences of his values. And that's where his life, as a life of comes together with ours. So he looked radical because he based his life on an essential rooting teaching, insight, understanding, and followed where that led him. He was grounded in his teaching of a natural universe. He was grounded in his teaching of living in accord with it. And he was rooted in his how to do this living in accord with this view of a natural universe, his how-to of, what shall we say, of meditation or zazen, of bringing awareness into daily life, of living an ethical life of restraint and generosity, and of grounding all these in a dharma of a natural, impermanent, interdependent universe. So every step he took was a step inconsistent where he stepped from, he stepped forward. We step forward wavering. We're not quite so sure that from where we're standing now, the next foot, the next choice, is going to really continue and develop where we're coming from. It always does, but not always in ways we understand. And the more awareness and clarity we have of having a foot behind us and a foot in front of us, and that we're always moving between the two, makes it easier to accept that where we're going, what we're doing, is creating the where we're going. He didn't have a where to go. He did it with each foot. Each choice, each day, was expressing what there was to do next without knowing what that was. And so it is for us. No matter how much of a teaching there is, it doesn't tell us what to do next. Thank goodness. It's not fundamentalism. It says, here's a foundation to stand on and to guide you reaching out with the next foot. Can I take a next step that's in accord with my understanding, in accord with my values? Can I remember to do that? over and over. And when I forget, can I find a way to return to remembering over and over? This is what we mean by the direction of practice. Not that there is a particular place to put your foot. We want one. I want one as much as you do, a place to put my foot down, the next step. And there isn't one, but there is a continuing. When the more it the our practice and our values are in our skin, bones, flesh, and marrow, the more it's with us as we take a next step. And we don't know how that's going to be, but if we can take that next step and then let what happens inform us, we can take it, and then it's still part of our world of understanding and practice, and we take another step. This is what's meant by to follow the way. In some ways, it's a misnomer, you know, because there isn't really a way to follow. It's a way to create at each moment. At the same time, there is a sense of a path that is always there. In one sense, there's a path that's already there. And another, as one Zen master once said, the way opens before you as you walk. You make it open. It opens in your taking a step. No other way. That's the only way there can be a practice and a teaching that really expresses your life, and that your life expresses as part of something larger all at the same time. If I just had my own life to express on figuring out just from what I knew, yes, in that sense, boy, my foot is wavering and it's not going to find ground and I'm going to stumble and fall. But if what is really all, my personal life is grounded in and rooted, radically rooted in something larger that helps me orient to for my foot to sense ground and to have something to carry with me and eyes to see with as I go and a heart to feel with as I go and some sense of an understanding to try to organize this crazy world as I find myself in each moment, then there's a movement, a direction or called following or entering the way that's going in the direction of coherence and continuity. I think that's the peace that Shakyamuni had. He had illness, he had old age, and he had death for himself, and in all his monks around him, and all his nuns, and all the lay followers, whom he was very fond of. So he didn't have a peace of removal. He was very much out there, trudging around in the dust in the world. But he had an integrated and coherent life. And for us, it's a sense of direction. That's why we say there's a sense of direction. We don't see ourselves as integrated, consistent, continuous, and coherent. We tend to see that ourselves as disjointed, and once in a while we see coherence, and sometimes we put them together in one place and then they break apart again. Our path is the going in the direction of coherence and continuity and living by our understanding and our values. We're going in that direction now. And now, and now. So Shakyamuni's life, as itself a teaching, is in the way he lived his teachings, and that's a very important aspect of it. Otherwise, it's sort of really outside. And that only listened to a few a few minutes at the beginning of the PBS show. And if anyone hasn't seen it and wants to, it is all available right now online at pbs.org/Buddha. For a week or two, they'll leave it up, the whole thing, for free. And you can buy the DVD. And then I suppose they'll take it down, encouraging sales or whatever. But the whole thing is up and available right now. So I'm going to go back and look at some more of it. And it's somewhere in the early minutes, the Dalai Lama says, Buddha's responsibility is just to show us the way. That's all. That's all. We're all radicals. We're all roots. That's our life. Roots with feet and shoes on, running shoes on. Out of figuring out how to do that. That's all I have to say. Who saw the PBS show? You saw it? Huh? Yeah, a lot of people. Huh? Did you like it? Yeah. I liked the bit I saw. What?
I didn't like it.
You didn't like it.
No, I just thought it was the cartoons were kind of silly. And
you didn't like the cartoons. I thought the cartoons were the best part.
Do you like cartoons?
They weren't cartoons. They were artwork. They were just interpreted artwork.
Anyway, so that you're entitled. Okay, you didn't like the. There was so you said it was maybe simplistic seeming to you.
We should.
Nielsen, we can cut. This is our person.
I think some of the people.